Hello and welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast. Me, Matt Beadle here with the voice of goalkeeping, Richard Lee.
Hello, Matthew.
Hello, Richard.
Quite the podcast ahead.
Indeed. Do you know what? I was thinking about this before, and if you could have the ultimate title that a goalkeeper coach would want, I think this gentleman has it. Head of goalkeeping for the FA and England. It's like the ultimate title.
Yeah, I think you might be right. It's the kind of thing that if you're in a bar and someone asks you, what do? You know, like some people lie and just say they're a dolphin trainer or something just to try and make them sound more interesting than they actually are. Whereas this, I think you would quite proudly tell everyone. In fact, I wouldn't even wait until they asked me what I did. I think I'd just tell them openly, this is what I do, just in case you want to know.
Before they've even asked,
I'd introduce myself as... We're about to say the gentleman's name, and I would say, this is what I do, just so you know. Just so that probably is going to spark some conversation. So off you go, ask questions. And that's what we did. That's essentially what we did.
It's exactly what we did with Tim Ditmar, the head of goalkeeping for the FA and England, who is coming up and is a really honest, open, just knowledgeable gent. Really enjoyed this.
So knowledgeable. Yeah, so, so knowledgeable. And I think that... The more we were having the conversation, the more that I really appreciated that he's so process-driven, and the way in which he sees things and the way in which he articulates things, it's next level. Next level. Really, really good interview. There's so much that you can take, whether you are, again, a coach, a player. His journey is very interesting too. To get to the level that he is, and he's still not, well, he's not old. He's younger than me. He's younger than us. I mean, you're older than me. But yeah, you know, for him to be the age he is and to be where he is, just phenomenal.
Okay, without further ado, over to Tim Ditmar. This week's guest is a man with a mission to unearth, inspire and empower future generations of England goalkeepers and goalkeeping coaches. As a player, he came through Liverpool's academy prior to a spell at Vauxhall Motors. As a coach, he's worked at City's Bradford and Manchester. Now he's head of goalkeeping at the FA and England. Tim Ditmar, welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
Morning, guys. Thank you for having me. Nice intro.
Thank you very much. Great to have you on. I can see that Richard's already forgotten about the three quickfire questions that we opened the podcast with.
You know, I'm still going to ask these three questions. We have these three quickfire questions, which is favourite gloves, favourite kit that you ever wore, and most memorable save that you have. So I am still going to ask them. Let's go with that. Are you able to endorse a brand of gloves?
I could get in trouble there, couldn't I?
I was going to say, this is why it's a little bit awkward to ask you these questions. But
let's do it.
The kit, I'm sure I could ask. What's the favourite kit that you had?
No. Let's go gloves.
What's the favourite gloves?
I have a pair stuck in my head that I used to wear. I've got loads that I used to love. But I think the pair that stick in my head were a pair of Sondicos. I'm sure they call like SGRs. Like they were black with ridges across them. They're like two white fingers, like a punching zone on them. They're the player that stick in my head bring back the fondest memories, I think.
So do you know what? Matt's shaking his head because that's my pair of gloves. It was SRGs. So you had the SMGs SRGs. Yeah, that was it. The SMGs, I think, were for wet weather maybe, and the SRGs were the summer glove from memory. Oh, great gloves. What happened to Sondico? Anyway, that's another conversation. Okay, your favourite kit?
My favourite kit? It'd have to be a black one, which helped with the... visual body shape, I think, in the early days. Now I remember wearing we had when I played for Vauxhall, actually one of the coaches actually worked for Adidas. He was like head of football for Adidas, so we were fully kitted out in all decently Adidas gear. So I think we might have been the worst team in the league with the best kit. So now we had some great gear, but that Adidas kit that year was excellent.
I was gonna say, that's quality at that level. That's fantastic. What was the favorite save you ever made?
It was at Boston away. I think it was just a league game against Boston, and ball got to the byline where the 18 meets the touchline. So I've come kind of front half of the goal, not quite squared off, but in the front half, and he's hung it up, like, you know, dinked it to the back. So you've turned and ran across your goal. The lad has arrived and like volleyed it on the full. So as I've arrived, he's arrived, like, I don't know, 10 yards out to volley it. I can't save it, so I just threw myself, but I caught it flush, like with my hand, like literally hand on the line. How it went over the bar, no one knows. So it would be that save, but I do have to say that we did concede from the resulting corner. So
is there any video footage of the save? I've got to ask, any video footage of the save?
I'll have a look for it. I'll see what I can find, but I don't know. I'll have a look.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Tim, it's brilliant having you on. Like I said, I think throughout the course of this conversation, we'll get right into the nitty-gritty of the England goalkeeper DNA, the last 8 years or so that you've been with the England setup, everything else around goalkeeping, your philosophy, coaching players, etc., etc. But before we do that, I'd quite like to just dig into how you came to be where you are, your background in goalkeeping, where you started, and your journey, I guess.
So I was quite late into like goalkeeping as regards like coaching and stuff. So I was only first coached at like, I don't know, 12, 13. I was just an all-rounder really, played lots of different sports, could do anything. So I started specialising in goalkeeping quite late, like 13-ish. Academy trials at 14. So I wasn't in the academy system. I just played for like school, town, county, stuff like that. And only got into academy system at 14 when I signed for, I was with Everton for a while, but then signed for Blackburn. With Blackburn for about 2 years, and they didn't offer me a scholarship. They had another really good keeper there, a lad called David Stevenson, who was an excellent goalkeeper. And then some others around me were like Stephen Drench, who was excellent. And then Frank Fielding was a couple of years younger than us, who was excellent as well. So they had some great goalkeepers at that time. So I didn't get offered the scholarship, which I was gutted about. So then I went on trial and started trialing everywhere and got a trial at Liverpool. And they needed they wanted to take two scholars and they couldn't find anyone. And I went along on trial and just did really well. And I think they just thought, oh, he's you know, quite raw, you know, he's got some potential, can kick on. And yeah, signed for Liverpool, which was amazing really, to not get signed at Blackburn and sign for Liverpool. And I spent two years there, like a scholarship, released in my third year, but great experiences, great players that I played with and coaches that I was coached by, you know, namely people like Steve Highway, Joe Corrigan, Dave Shannon, John Owens, Hugh McCauley, people like that. Part-time goalkeeping coach was Billy Stewart, who was really good for us, but only 2 days a week, not on a match day. During my time there, I was selected to play for Ireland. My mother's Irish, my mother's family's Irish, so I went and played for Ireland for a couple of seasons, which was, again, great experiences, great players, great coaches. And then, yeah, as Liverpool released me, they gave me some advice that was like, I think they noticed that during my time there, I was quite a good communicator, I was quite mature, I was quite a logical thinker. So they just said, look, we think you'd be a good coach one day. And I guess they just, you know, shone the light in that direction for me. And I, just started doing my badges and stuff there from then on.
Yeah, it's fascinating to hear that, because there's a few stories that I've heard like this recently where at that moment, was there not, in fact, a couple of things I want to touch on here. Firstly, the Blackburn thing. You mentioned, I didn't realise you were that sort of era, Drenchy and Frank Fielding. I had a year up at Blackburn myself, and he was a really, really good goalkeeper, Stephen Drench. He was one that, I remember his distribution was phenomenal, like way beyond his years. And from memory, I know he wasn't huge, which I hate to say, but you know, you look back and you wonder whether that was maybe a reason he didn't quite kick on.
Yeah, maybe. What you say is right. He was definitely a good goalkeeper. Very, very good. I think he was a year below me. Outstanding distributor, both feet. He did go and play for Guiseley.
That's right, yeah.
Who were a good team in the league. Played a lot of games for them. But if in the right team, he was very effective. I'm convinced he could have played in the league. No problem.
Yeah, no, likewise. And in terms of then, so leaving Liverpool, because I guess when you're leaving a club of that stature, like you look at it now, an 18-year-old gets released from a top four, top six club, even top 10 club in the Premier League. Ordinarily, the normal pathway now would be they would go on trial at maybe some Championship clubs, League One clubs, and find a home at maybe one of those clubs and then move on from there. Was it one where you did then go on a few trials after that?
I went the exit. Do you remember the exit trials you used to run at Lillishaw?
Yeah.
I went to them and did okay at that and got offered quite a lot of trials. And I have to say, like, thinking back then, I just had my head in the sand a little bit as regards, like, you deserve something better. And I didn't kind of realise the steps and the process and the pathway that I needed to go on to then continue my career. So whereas now I can articulate that quite well as regards different pathways or different routes and careers, I don't think anyone had done that with me, and I just didn't understand. And I kind of turned my nose up at like a few trials and stuff, thinking, you know, I'm not going there. And I just didn't realise. So I ended up starting the next season, not even playing. I was like, I'll just leave it. You know, I'll leave it for a bit and see what happens. And that's when I was contacted by, there was a connection between Liverpool and Vauxhall Motors. Yeah. Vauxhall Motors were kind of Conference North or whichever at the time. And they said, like, oh, do you want to just come along and train then? So I went along and trained. And I got there and thought, look at that, this is really good, this. You know, really good standard of football, playing against good opposition, you know, other big clubs or relatively big clubs, you know, down at that level. And I was like, wow, this was men's football. It was like it was a shock to how difficult it was, to how rewarding it was when you played well, playing in front of a crowd, you know, all them old cliches, mortgage football, all that. It was like, wow, didn't even realise that world existed. So I guess that ignited like a little bit of a passion where I could potentially help other people further down the line. So yeah, if I could go back, I wouldn't change it because I am where I am now. But I do think it's better that people have more awareness of them roots.
Yeah, well, do you know, I find it fascinating that there's a couple of things I want to touch on here, actually. One is when you described, or you were described as being a very logical thinker, which I'm going to go into that because of how I see coaching now and the top coaches. And you sort of see a theme that seems to run through or similar qualities that a lot of the top coaches have is that sort of process driven logical thinking, which allows you to kind of dissect a goalkeeper's game. I do want to go into a bit of detail on that, because I'd love to know your sort of methodology when it comes to goalkeepers, building goalkeepers. But also the other bit I found fascinating is that you had both ends of the spectrum, because we're seeing the journey that a lot of the goalkeepers are taking these days. And actually this applies to a lot of the England goalkeepers as well, in that they are playing at those levels at some point, and the different challenges that a goalkeeper will get playing at those levels, which then help them in a big way when they do eventually rise back up and play at Championship Premier League level. So I'd love to start with that part of it, actually, in that you did get to play at that level, and now you see a lot of the goalkeepers go and do that. What for you were the different challenges playing in the Conference North?
Just I suppose difference would be the best word to use. Like, this, how we played at Liverpool was one way, and then how I needed to play when I went down to playing at that level was difference, really. You know, you couldn't take you could take minimal risk. You know, risk is a subject in itself, but you could take minimal risk. You had to manage the games more. You had to manage other people's emotions more, whether they were coming towards you or you were going towards them. Obviously, the fans, the money side of it that was involved, the pressure to do with, you know, the league table. You know, your reports were written up every week and, you know, released in the non-league weekly paper, things like that. So there was always scouts at the games, you know, scouts looking for routes back in for professional football. So, yeah, I guess it was just that difference. And then the obvious one would be like the kicking it long, you know, kicking long a lot more was obvious. And then the aerial stuff, the crosses into the box, you were exposed on that. So you just, it was kind of live or die, really, sink or swim. You had to do it, otherwise you wouldn't have been in the team.
So you said as well, Tim, that I think it was at Liverpool, you said they gave you some advice that you were a good communicator, that you were quite mature. Is that, I'm presuming, what then led you into where you are now? You started to think about coaching?
Yeah, I guess so. I remember when I was at Liverpool, and I do hear some keepers do this now, but when I was at Liverpool, I remember shouting on the pitch to some of the players to like kind of help them or encourage them. And I'd use their full name. So I'd give them like their surname, the Christian name, which sounds a bit weird. But in my head, I thought that they would respond to that better when they'd done something well, or when they needed a G-up. If you give them the first and Christian name, it's going to like kind of like jolt their senses a little bit, to be like, oh, bloody hell, I need to kick on here, or I'm getting rewarded for something. So I remember like trying to connect with people like that. Whether that worked or not, I'm not sure. But I hear some people do that now as well. And I guess that's just a connection piece, isn't it? Around like how you connect with other individuals, how you empower people, how you make them think and feel. And I just thought I could play that role from my position to help others and make the team play better, yeah.
I can't imagine that.
That's a fascinating one. That's because I think I always remember getting told, what's it? Communication isn't what's said, it's what's received. So it's the understanding that if you can effectively communicate to those in front of you, again, that can make your job that much easier. However, it's not necessarily something that's seen. You watch on TV, I watch the Premier League goalkeepers. I wouldn't know who's a fantastic communicator necessarily, because of course you can't hear them. But that in itself, by doing that, I'm guessing that, as you say, if nothing else, if your communication is quite descriptive, you're using their full name, if nothing else, they are going to hear you. They can't ignore you, I guess, if you're going to... Yeah. I actually haven't heard that. I haven't heard of another goalkeeper that does that.
And it wasn't all the time. I wasn't doing it like every single pass. It was only at key moments where, like I say, someone needed either like kind of like their arm around them and loved a bit for doing what they'd done, or praising them, or they needed, you know, a kick up the ass.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, so I suppose then moving on to, because I really want to get into the way in which you got into the coaching world. So did you go down the route of getting your different coaching badges? I'm guessing you got your level one as being part of the Liverpool setup, and then did they do a level two while you were at Liverpool?
Yeah, I did an award at Liverpool as a scholar, which was with Neil Bailey, who's a brilliant coach educator, worked for the PFA now. I still see Neil, excellent. So I had that award, but then bizarrely, like as I left Liverpool, I was literally back there within 12 months, really, kind of like this, you know, they said, do you want to do a little bit of scouting, go out and watch some grassroots football? The next thing I'm taking, like, I don't know, an under 13 in to say, like, go and have a trial. And then the next minute I'm like stood there watching the trial, and it's like, why don't you just go and get the balls in, bring your boots, get the balls. Before you know it, it's like, well, why don't you help out in the session? And at the same time, I was taking my coaching badges, and I'd done my level two, and I think I was enrolled on my UEFA B. But that's when the academies became a lot more stringent on their qualifications, mandatory qualifications by UEFA. And a couple of the youth goalkeeping coaches there just didn't have them, didn't have qualifications. So there became a pinch point where they said, look, do you want to do it? And I was really young. I was like 23, 24, I think. I can't remember off the top of my head. And I was back in coaching, like, within a couple of years of leaving. So, yeah, I did do my qualifications, but I was coaching all the time, guys. I was like, and I say this when I get asked the question, what advice would I give to young coaches, is coach everything all the time as much as you can. And I'm talking soccer schools, disability football, homeless football, different sports, after-school clubs, academy football, like, you name, one-to-ones, you name it, I did it. And abroad, coached abroad, yeah, literally did so much coaching that I just became like so adaptable to any session or any scenario. And you get it now, like when the pros, yeah, when the ex-pros come and become coaches, what they don't struggle with their information and their understanding of the game. They struggle with how to impart that on the group or on the individuals. And the only way you get good at that is by doing it. So, yeah, that exposure I had to all them different experiences as a youngster was unbelievable, really.
And I guess with all those different experiences, you would have been meeting and working with lots of different top coaches as well. So am I right in thinking it'd be the same as, you know, we say to young goalkeepers often, find elements and attributes of different goalkeepers that you like and look to mirror match whatever it is that you do. Is it a similar thing in the coaching world, and that you're taking elements of different coaching styles and bringing it into your own style?
Yeah, well, I was so lucky there. I was so lucky because, like, a typical day for me could look like going joining with Liverpool's 18s or 23s as a coach and a player. I could then in the afternoon go and coach in a school that might, worked with disability children. And then in the evening, I'd go and train or play in the conference or Conference North. The next morning, I'd turn up at Liverpool and it'd be like, can you go up with the first team and watch them train or take someone up there? Then I'd be watching Pepe Reina or Jersey or whoever was the first team keepers there. So I was getting exposed to so many different things and just lapping it all up, really. And I can't remember which keeper it was, but I remember being out on the pitch with one of the keepers, and we started speaking about like the side volley. And it was like, have you seen this keeper in Spain doing this side volley? We're like, yeah, no, I've not. Who was that? And we started discussing it. And this was like early 2000s. And so like just picking up trends and differences back then and just trying them really was, yeah, what you say is right, really. Just you take little bits from everyone.
It's so funny when that did come in, and I'll always remember, do you know, it's funny, you know, you have that kind of moment. And for me, it was, I remember seeing Lenny Pidgley do it back in the day, did a side in the same game. It was like on a 23 or reserve game, whatever it was at the time. Mm. And in the same game, he's done a side volley and he's done one where the ball's come back to him and he's just clipped it over a fullback into, or clipped over the strike into fullback's feet.
Yeah.
And I remember the coaches on the side were so negative about it, like as if, oh, I was showing off, this, that, the other. And like, you look at how goalkeeping is now, which look, we're going to come on to that now basically very shortly, because yeah. It's just, it is incredible how much goalkeeping has developed over the last 15 years, which then I suppose comes on to, what was the transition there from you into England? Was it a case of an opportunity came up? How did that transition take place?
Yeah, well, there's quite a big gap there in like when I started coaching to England. I coached before I was employed by England. I'd done 9 years of coaching, so like, you know, I'd done probably 10 years of coaching. Like, I'd done an awful lot of coaching at all levels, you know, from like six-year-old grassroots all the way up to, you know, first team in league. So I did a bit of everything, and I was still playing myself. So I think that period of like, you've got the 10,000 hour theory, haven't you? That period of like upskilling myself and learning was so rich that I was, you know, playing, coaching, been around amazing managers. Like the first team manager that I coached with was Peter Taylor. You know, who's the ex-England manager and England under 21 manager, worked in the Prem. So I had some exposure like to people like that. And you know, you have to sink and swim in them scenarios. So yeah, I don't know if that answers that question, but
yeah, well, it kind of, I suppose this, you know, I mentioned we get a lot of listens, a lot of coaches will be listening into this now, a lot that would love to follow in your footsteps. Certainly, you mentioned a lot of the younger goalkeepers that maybe it hasn't quite happened and they're looking at the next step and how they can maximise what it is they do. And I guess, look, it's the same thing that applies to playing in goal, in that, you know, you talk about the 10,000 hours to excellence, and was it the book Bounce? I always remember a lot of the ideas given in that. And if anything, you want to expose yourself to as many different situations, good and bad, because of course you're going to learn. I'm sure there must have been a session or two that you did that didn't go particularly well, but then of course it's those sessions that then I'm sure are some of the biggest learning curves in terms of how you then progressed as a coach.
Yeah, 100%. And like, you know, part of my role now as a coach developer or coach educator as well, because I deliver the courses, is like the advice and guidance that I try and give people is normally I'm giving advice, not things I've got right, things that I've got wrong. So I look back to how I behaved as a coach as a youngster, and you know, 25, 26, and the sessions I put on, and how I thought as a coach. Like I look back and think, bloody hell, what was I playing at? And I even think like some of the keepers I coached at that age, young keepers or old keepers, although they will have enjoyed the sessions, they might be going, bloody hell, what was he like, what was he doing different now than what he did then? Because like if it was that, like I can't see any point of difference. But I guess you learn from your shortfalls and your miscomings and hopefully learn from that. And I think an important thing with that is like helping people. Not teaching, because teaching suggests that you know you've got the knowledge and you're imparting it, but helping people how to think, not what to think.
Yeah.
I think that's a big thing, is like structuring people's thinking and thought process, not this is what you need to think and do.
Yeah. And I guess with that, it's that idea of almost, you don't want to create a robot. You don't want to just tell them what to do. Yeah, you want to create. That makes sense. So if we can move on then, so the job with the FA, with England, was that the actual moment that happened? How did that come about? Was it a case of applying or were you headhunted?
Yeah, so I'd continued with my qualifications that you've mentioned. So like my B license, my goalkeeping B license, my outfield A license, my goalkeeping A license. So I went and got qualified with them, as well as coaching at a good level. So I was coaching for Bradford. Moved to Man City, spent 2.5 years at Man City, or 3 seasons at Man City. And then literally got a phone call one night. I used to work stupid hours. I got home one night, walked in the house, and Martin Thomas rang me. And I thought, like, Tomo didn't ring me that much, really. So I better take this. And he said, we've got an under-20 World Cup going on. He said, they're on the prep camp. And he said, Simon Smith's just twisted his knee. and he can't do the rest of the camp. Can you go and jump on a 3-day camp? So I was like, 100%. You know, so Chetford City, they said, yeah, and it was quite near my house. It was at Carden Park. Okay. So I turn up the next day at Carden Park, walk in the room. Who's the head coach? Peter Taylor. So Peter's like, flipping heck, how have you got here? You know, one of them, like, fancy seeing you here. So anyway, I did like a 4-day camp. And they basically said to me, Tomo said, look, if Simon's injured for the whole tournament, do you fancy doing it? And I was like, yeah. So before I knew it, like, I was in Turkey at the Under 20 World Cup. And I knew a couple of the players there that had coached when I was at Liverpool and stuff. People like Connor Cody, John Flanagan, Ross Barkley that I knew. And then some at the 20s World Cup, which was a bit of a whirlwind experience, really. It didn't go very well. Came back. And then as I was out there, that's when Dan Ashworth took over. It was like the technical director at the FA. And Dan was going to do quite a big restructure and modernisation. And he talked to me when I was out there and said, look, it's probably a role coming up. You know, I've seen how you've worked. I know what you do. Spoke to City. Would you be interested in applying for it? So, in the September, the role come up. And, you know, the rest of history, really, 7 years down the line, or 8 years.
So that's it, really, isn't it? We talk about being presented with an opportunity, and you've had that opportunity and really taken it. Was there any part of you when you went on that camp at that Under 20 World Cup? I know that you said it didn't go particularly well for the team, I suppose. It was a bit of a turbulent campaign. But did you feel any pressure, or did you just go and think, right, I'm going to embrace this now. I'm going to show them what I can do. And as a result, hopefully something else might come from it.
Yeah, the latter really, Matt. Like, I thrive off them moments, like when I've got pressure, or when I've got a deadline, or when there is something to deliver. Like, I thrive off them. I love them. Like, it really motivates me. So when I got the 20s World Cup there, opportunity, I bounce in there like I belong there. And thinking that the three keepers, like, I just bounced in, you know, started coaching them, you know, doing what I was doing, working with the squad, fitting in with everyone, all the coaches. And then when we're out in Turkey at the World Cup, someone says to me, oh, Ray will be coming out close to the games. And I'm like, oh, right, Ray who? Like, Ray Clemens. So I'm like, really? Like, yeah. So Ray comes out, and I think I'd met Ray once or twice before, but definitely didn't know him. So I got to know Ray out there. So I'm taking a session with Sam Johnson, George Long, and Connor Ripley. And Ray Clemens is watching the session. I'm like, doing stuff and thinking, oh my God, like, what is going on here? It didn't bother me, but I was just like, this is unbelievable. Yeah. And then got close with Ray after that. Yeah, the pressure bit, Matt, really doesn't bother me. If anything, it's the opposite. Yeah, I love that. Love them moments. And I think that helps me now in my role, like the audiences I deliver to now, and the people I, you know, deliver in front of, like people like, you know, Gareth, and that is, yeah, that's what I live for, really. I love that.
But it must be, because I see a lot of the, I've been to a couple of the MLS conventions, and I don't know if you've done any of them, but where, again, a lot of these sessions you're doing in front of large audiences, and actually a lot now are filmed as well, aren't they? So you know that there are, you know, when I go on YouTube and watch some of the sessions that take place, there's thousands and thousands of hits on these as well. So there is actually, you know that it's not just you and the goalkeepers, which it might be at a lot of the clubs at the moment. The goalkeeper session, they go and do it, and it's only a, you know, you go off into a corner somewhere and do the session that you're going to do. But you're actually, more often than not, when you're doing a session, it is being seen by the public.
Yeah, no, but I don't know. I just like them pressure moments. That's what energizes me and gives me motivation, I guess, whether they're on the pitch or off the pitch. I definitely strive on them.
I really want to dig into what it is that you look for in goalkeepers. And I assume that, to an extent, obviously every goalkeeper is different and each goalkeeper has different strengths and how you work with that. But when you transition to the FA, to England, is there a certain, like, a set methodology that they have, certain attributes they look for in an England goalkeeper, given how, say, Gareth Southgate plays and the kind of attributes that a goalkeeper will need in order to be successful in that team, keeping possession of the ball, etc. Is there like a model of a goalkeeper, a DNA of a goalkeeper that you have?
Yes, there is, but it's not a set defined structured one, Rich. It's more of an outcome based setup. So let me explain. So, but when I arrived at the FA, I stepped into the department and was lucky enough to work with Simon Smith and Martin Thomas, who obviously fantastic coaches and mentors and friends more than anything, and started working within all the groups. And I was probably drawing back on the experiences that I'd been exposed to at all the different clubs and being abroad as well, coaching and stuff, that I was like, I was probably looking at what English keepers, and this is generalisation, I know, I was probably looking at what English keepers couldn't do. And I was thinking, right, what can't we do? What are we? So again, gross generalisation. I was thinking, like, do we take risks with the ball at our feet? Probably not. You know, we don't take any risks. Do we leave our goal, like, to support play? No, not at all. Are we athletically, are we efficient in our movement? Do we move well? Probably not. We're probably a bit stiff. Do we make enough big saves? Probably not. So I was looking at all them little bits and thinking, right, this is where I want to add value. And probably the best memory I've got, and I can describe this, is we run goalkeeping camps at the, three or four a year, where we invite the best keepers in the country in for 3 or 4 days and do some stuff with them. And I think back to the first camps I did, and they were great. I used to do them with Simon. And I remember putting on, Simon would give me part of it to coach, and I would put on a sort of a session on maybe something to do with blocking or big saves, and an in-possession session to do with support, receiving and distribution. And I just remember, like, physically, the guys couldn't move the hips to get into a blocking position. Like, the hips were too stiff. They weren't set up properly. And then their in-possession game, they just didn't understand how to exploit space by their positioning or by what they did with the ball. So I was like, we'd have 12 kids, and honestly, two of them could do it, and 10 of them couldn't. And I fast forward to 2021, when we have our goalkeeping camps now, and it's the opposite way around. 10 can do it and 2 can't. So what that means to me is the coaching that's going on in the clubs and the environments that these younger goalkeepers are now exposed to are much more all-encompassing to the whole game. And I think we're getting better goalkeepers because of it.
And on that note, so actually off air, I asked you the question about whether you speak to a lot of the goalkeeper coaches and visit a lot of the goalkeeper coaches. Is that your influence to an extent, or is it just the fact now that certainly in the Premier League, and there are other teams, Championship, League One, you know, I was watching MK Dons play, I watched a lot of their games, and, like, you know, the way they play, the way they get the goalkeepers to play, you know, really very much possession based and taking risks, etc. So it is now not just top end Premier League, it is filtering down the division. So is that your impact to any extent, or is it just the fact that football's going that way and these clubs individually are now bringing up their goalkeepers in that way?
I don't think it's my impact, and that's how I wanted to answer the question when you asked about, you know, do I have a methodology, or and my answer to that is no, it's not me, it has to be all of us. And when I say all of us, I mean all the coaches at the FA and all the coaches in the clubs and across the grassroots. It is all of us, Rich. Like, it's not like the Tim Ditmer Show or the Tim Ditmer FA or anything like that. It's got to be, we've got to have our own unique way of thinking. And that's, if you think back to before, when I said about teaching people how to think, not what to think, it probably links to that point. So I suppose I wanted to take the shackles off what people thought was acceptable and what people were capable of doing, including the players and the coaches. So, no, it isn't my way, but we, after a couple of years, we sat down and we just recruited a couple more coaches. So Simon had left, and we recruited a couple of coaches to come in and work in the goalkeeping department. So that was Richard Hartis and Jack Robinson. So Rich is at Man United now, and Jack's at Liverpool. So they started working with us, and I really wanted to kind of sit down and say, right, what are we looking for in our goalkeepers? And we started this. It took a year to do. We put together a list of characteristics. And I've done this before, and it starts off as, like, you know, good at handling, can dive low, can dive medium, can dive. And you end up with a list as long as your arm. So what we went down, we went down outcome-based characteristics. So is able to make big saves, effective in their actions, outstanding at distribution, can exploit space, can move efficiently. So we're not defining that you've got to do it a certain way. We're saying you have to be able to do this outcome. And that leaves wriggle room, individualization and empowerment for coaches and players to kind of, like, bring their uniqueness to the game. And my hope is that can be seen now in, like, I think we're getting much more a variety in our goalkeepers now rather than just one type. So I'll share the characteristics with you and send that over to you to have a look, and you can, I don't know, you can post it if you want or whatever. But it's massively helped us. And what it doesn't do, it doesn't say to the coaches in their context, right, you've got to use these characteristics. It says, come up with your own. You know, what do you want from your goalkeepers? What do you want them to be? How do you want them to act? How do you want them to behave? And I think the best analogy, I think I'm going to chuck two analogies out here. I could get a bit stick for this. I think the best analogy is, I don't imagine, well, I'll ask you the question. Have you ever got on a plane and you don't know where it's going to?
No.
No, I agree. So normally you get on a plane, if you're Richard Lee, it's probably going to land in California. If it's me or Matt, probably landing in Guernsey or something. So you get on a plane and it flies over to California, but it does, you know, veer offline along the way and, you know, slightly move one way or the other every now and again, but it does land in California. And it's the same with this. When you're developing a goalkeeper, or, you know, taking someone on that journey from where they're at to somewhere else, you've got to know where you're going in order to try and stay on track and, you know, do the things you need to do. So, yeah.
It's the process with all of this that really interests me as well, Tim, because you speak of that DNA, you speak of that four-corner model that you guys have now, the technical, the physical, the psychological, the social, which ultimately leads to the tactical. And I think the process for me, you said there it took a year. It's not like you and Richard Hartis and Gareth Southgate have gone and booked a 4 p.m. in a meeting room at St George's Park with a cup of tea and a few digestives and gone, oh, let's do this, we'll brainstorm. It's actually taken a year for you guys to thrash out this plan.
Yeah, it took so long. I look back, like, I could have killed Rich on a few of the days. No, could have killed him. And the people at the hotel we did it at, we kind of went once a week or once a month, and they knew our round, they knew what we were drinking. Like, right, two coffees and a cappuccino. Yeah, you're on Caesar salad. You're on. So it was hilarious. Like, they knew what we were doing. But then once we'd done it in a small group, we then took it out to like different parties, so other sports, other goalkeeping coaches, current players, ex-players, outfield coaches. Yes, Gareth was involved. So we really, like, I don't know, you might want to call that like a stress test. Like, we stress test it against all different contexts to see whether it was robust enough to roll out. And it took so long, but it was so worthwhile because, you know, we've changed little bits of it so far, but not too much. And it's been really good. And sometimes it can come across a bit cheesy when you use it with the players, but we use it with the players. Like, so when I'm working with Aaron Ramsdale, or when I work with Jordan, you know, we sit down and speak to them about these parts of the game. So you might sit down and speak to, let's say Aaron about, right, go on, Aaron, you know, have you made enough big saves, or are you a winner? How's your nerve strength? You know, did you exploit space today? And, you know, we have these conversations with the lads, and it's been so useful, and it just keeps us on track, to be honest. You know, we always come back to it. It keeps us on track.
Yeah. I want to ask you about, you mentioned it a couple of times there, because we spoke about this a bit on the podcast, and I'm intrigued by the idea of the big save. And is this for you? Is it psychological? Is it physical? Is it a bit of both? And what I mean by that is, you know, a big save, for instance, might be, in fact, we're about to do our weekly podcast after this, and we'll touch on some of the big moments from the games over the last couple of nights. And, you know, it was a great save at the end of the Oxford game, for instance. Jack Stevens, last minute, moves his feet well, gets himself into a great position, great reaction. So for me, it's a bit of everything. So it's the physical to get there. It's the mental to be strong enough in that moment, to be focused enough in that moment to execute the save at the right time, you know, a crucial moment of the game. So is it a little bit of everything that comes into that?
Yeah, you're right. All these things interlink, but then you wouldn't make a big save if you weren't able to do all them things around, recognition, positioning, efficient movement, correct stance, things like that. We have big save in there. We measure all these things as well. Like, we measure them in our performance, with the lads' performance and the girls' performance. We measure everything. And the definition of big save for us is an unexpected or result-defining save. Now, you probably straight away, you're thinking, yeah, that's probably a little bit grey there, Tim. But, like, I didn't want this to be just black and white. You want some wriggle room for, like, why it was a big save, why it was, you know, why they were able, why was it result-defining, what were the what were then factors that were, you know, to do with conditions or previous mistakes or the crowd or the pressure. You know, we wanted some wriggle room for some like kind of like coach interpretation of it, not just to be, yes, it was a big save because he got 4 centimetres underneath the bar. That would be nonsense. We wanted that blend of like, we wanted that blend of subjectiveness and objectiveness in this as well.
Do you know, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit here, because this is one that, you know, I look at, you look at goalkeepers from around the world. It fascinates me for a start, by the way, you touch on how you saw goalkeeping, and like, I agree entirely. It was something that, I guess one of my frustrations when I played was that you kind of heard similar cliche comments about certain goalkeepers, and it was based on personal frustration as well, that I'm, you know, I'm 6 foot, and I knew that for certain people that was just never going to be quite big enough, which is fine because everyone's got their own ideas on what a goalkeeper would be. But actually, one of the reasons we do this podcast is it's quite nice to dig into some of the intricacies and actually what makes a highly effective goalkeeper. And sometimes the look of the goalkeeper may not necessarily mean that they are a highly effective goalkeeper. So that was like one of my, I suppose, personal angst that I had back in the day. But if you were then to, you mentioned that how you saw English goalkeeping, and when I look around the world, you've kind of got different attributes in different countries almost. You know, you look at how the Brazilians and the Alissons, Edisons, you look at France, the way in which goalkeepers there, obviously Italy over the years, Germany. Was it for you then taking certain attributes from each country, and do you have, so it's a double question here, do you have an idea in mind as to a goalkeeper, if you were to create the perfect goalkeeper, is it as simple as that, that you would then almost have someone that is 6'2" and has this and has that and has whatever, or is it not like that?
I don't think it's like that. And I have to be honest, it's a good question that I do mull over with myself. And I probably think my job would be easier if I was to state, it'd be easier for me if I was to state what that was, that profile, because I could just say, right, it's this size, this amount of movement, this fast, this technique, that, you know, and that would rule a load in and a load out. But then we'd end up with the same goalkeepers at every club, male and female, across the nation. Whereas I'm saying, like, what's, you know, some brilliant coaches in the country, you know, and we want to get the most out of them. So we want to bring the brilliant individual view that a coach in Southend might be able to add into goalkeeping game and spread that across the country, because it can't just be one way. You know, it surely can't. And You can't tell me that, you know, I know you guys mentioned that the Brazilian lads a lot at the moment. You can't tell me that when they were in their formative years, like 10 to 14, they had a coach drilling them on the exact technique to use. And because that's fundamentally, that didn't happen. And they both dive differently and kick differently and move differently. So I think you've got to embrace difference. You've got to embrace individuality, but always come back to, are they effective? And are they influencing the game and the team in a positive way? So the answer to that is no. I wouldn't give out that one size fits all approach and coach that. Try and bespoke how we coach to the needs of the individual that becomes most effective.
You mentioned male and female there, Tim. We actually had Carly Telford on the podcast a couple of years ago. In terms of your role at the FA in England, head of goalkeeping, does that include the women's game as well? And if so, what have you seen in the emergence of women's goalkeeping over the past few years?
Probably everything that we've just spoke about. So we've got some goalkeeping coaches in the women's department that I support. I definitely wouldn't have it down as like, oh, Tim runs it or Tim's in charge of it or anything like that. Like, I'm the same with the staff who I work with. I treat them the same as I treat the goalkeepers. You know, they're better than me at certain things, and I try and employ staff that bring difference to me, and they're different and they're better at things that I'm worse at. So we've got staff on the female side of the game who have implemented and interpreted this DNA, this approach, and put it into the women's game. And I think you can see how that's going. Like, it speaks for itself. We've got some, I've just been in with the senior women last camp, and, you know, it's so exciting to see where the game's going now. And we've had some great goalkeepers in the women's game, with like going back to Rachel and Carly, Siobhan, Karen. But like the squad is really young now, and like they're kind of like 22. I think their average age is 21, 22, the three that were in the last squad. So like, so exciting. And they're all different. I'm watching the three of them, and they're a bit like the senior men. The three of them were so different physically, so different technically. how they moved, how they distributed, how they thought, how they communicated. So it was actually quite a nice moment to say, this is happening on the women's side as well.
I want to touch on like a goalkeeper's journey. And again, you work with obviously some of the most elite goalkeepers. And I look and ask this question based on, I look at Dean Henderson, who was, what was he, Grimsby, Shrewsbury, Sheffield United, went League 2, League 1, might have even done National League as well, first. I think. Yeah, that's right. So it was, did everything. You know, I look at Marek Rodak, similarly League 2, League 1, Championship, and has played a game or so in the Premier League. So you look at a lot of these goalkeepers that do this, again, Joe Hart, Ben Foster, going back, they all had their time in the lower leagues. Do you champion that? And again, I guess there's only so much influence you can have over clubs or individuals, but in a perfect world, would your advice be to a lot of these elite goalkeepers to get yourself out on loan as quick as you can?
Yeah, there's different routes for everyone, but one route that seems to be really robust and proven at the moment is the one you've just described. And what we wouldn't do is force that on people and tell people that that's what they've got to do, and you know, nor could we. But what we would do is we would advise and give examples of and explain the benefits and the pitfalls as well that can come with it. But you know, the signs are there. Like you just look at who's played for, well, you look at the three senior keepers who've played for England over the last couple of years. You look at the lads in the 21s, then you could drop down a few age groups, 19s and 20s. Lincoln, where have I been this year? I've been to Gloucester. There's been a few lads in non-league, and they will just step up to Cheltenham. They will step up to the leagues this year and next year, and it just seems to be the best route for them, yeah. And the earlier, the better, really.
I've looked at a lot of videos as well over the past couple of years, Tim. Some of the stuff you do on social media is really good, and just that FA Learning platform on YouTube, watching some of the training drills, the techniques. And often when you compare, you know, training at the very highest level to grassroots, yes, it's very different in its technical form, but the essence of training is still there. You go out onto the training pitch and you train. I think one of the things that I've always noticed that has been different, especially in some of the stuff that you've put out there and then various adaptations that have, you know, arrived as a result of that, is the four-goal game. Can I ask you about that? You know, you've spoken a lot about this yourself, the four-goal game, because that is something that, you know, if you're not a coach, and maybe if you don't even understand football, you look at and you go, wow, that is just blowing my mind.
Yeah, now you've done your research, Matt. Good work, congrats. Yeah, so four goal game is a funny one, really. So where it came from, on the goalkeeping camp, we tend to bring in 16 goalkeepers from across the country. And what we do on the camp is we bring in an outfield team on one of the days. So instead of just doing goalkeeping sessions and just having goalkeepers versus goalkeepers, we bring in an outfield team, an academy. So Wolves, Birmingham, Burton Albion, Walsall have all been in and spent the day with us. And what we do, we put the lads or the girls into practices against their you know, direct rivals. And then we do some like co-coaching and some peer feedback with them. And you know, we get the strikers and we say to the keepers, right, when the strikers, what when is it hardest for you? What do the strikers do? So they give the strikers feedback and vice versa. So there's some really good stuff that goes on there. But the best exercise we use is this four-goal game. So it's basically, we started doing it years ago and we get to every camp and I always say, does the four-goal game survive or have we got something better? But it provides us so much. There's so many returns to that practice, Matt, that are performance indicators of their ability to play at the top level. So basically there's four goals, two 18-yard boxes, so it's like a, not quite a square, it's a rectangle. And basically you've got a keeper in each goal and a keeper in the middle, so you've got five players, and then you've got four players against them. And what you've got to do, you score a goal if the keepers keep the ball for eight passes, so there's a lot of round passes, through passes going on, or if they play a through pass which eliminates two of the opposition players, so you like dissect the opposition. If you give the ball away or you lose the ball, two balls come onto the pitch from the side and it's like a bit of a melee, you know, like it might be a cross, a volley, a 1v1. And so basically you get a bit of everything in there. It's high intensity, it's pressure, it's support positions, receiving skills, staying calm, picking the right pass, staying on the ball. But then when you give it away, it's like, can you defend the goal? And you're defending the goal in any manner of a way. You know, it might be a cross or a shot, as I just mentioned. So it's a really, I'm going to use this word again, it's a great performance indicator as to whether they can play at the top level, if they can do that. And going back years and years ago, it used to be a car crash. And now the lads come in and the girls, and they're so good at it now. Really good. It's very impressive.
Really is. And I'm not trying to take the mick out of you here, Richard. You often talk about your distribution and how the game has changed. Mm. Like, if you were thrown into that environment when you were a player, and I don't know whether you were, but if you were, do you think you would have been able to have dealt with it?
It's funny, you know, you touched on Martin Thomas said it. I always remember we did a day where it was at Wembley Stadium, the old Wembley Stadium. They did a training session. Martin Thomas took it, and it was all based on distribution. And I was the goalkeeper for it. And I'd never, ever done it. And it was the word you just used there, car crash. When I think back, I mean, Martin was lovely. Like, he always made you feel $1 million, you know, whenever you train. But I just remember, like, yeah, just it was just something we didn't do. And, you know, the back pass rule only came in when I was about 11 or 12, or whatever it was. So suddenly a lot of these skills that you needed just weren't there, which I think that, and again, even when the back pass rule did come in, all you really learned was how to kick it as far as you can first time. You didn't actually learn to take a touch and look to play. And this is what I love now when I see young goalkeepers, the way in which they're training. Training does seem to have been adapted, even your sort of local training, where it, I don't know, it might maybe used to be sort of 90% handling, 10% other stuff, which might involve crossing or a bit of distribution, whereas it does seem to be changing. In fact, I'll throw that to you, Tim. Have you seen that as well in the way?
Yeah, really easy question to answer. Huge shift. Massive shift. And that's fact. I've been around the country, watched majority of clubs and grassroots and stuff like that. And I think the rationale behind that, which would probably be your next question, I imagine, there's a nice saying, isn't there? I'm going to get this wrong. Matt will have to jump in and correct me, I'm sure. Something around, we're all born a genius, but society like constrains this in us or drains it out of us. Is that right, Matt?
Go on, Matt, we're testing you now. Come on, this is the kind of thing you need to know.
Do you know what? I'm going to say yes. I'm going to say you're pretty much, yeah, in and around what would be correct for that saying, I would say.
Okay, so my view on that is like with goalkeeping, if you start off teaching someone goalkeeping too restricted and compress it really early, it's really hard to expand it. Whereas if you give someone like that freedom and creativity at a young age to express themselves, to try things, to experiment on the pitch, to take risks, to do everything that they want to do, when it gets a bit more serious, that's when you can start refining it as a coach. That's when the coach can say, right, stop doing that now. You know, don't come that far out or take less risk. It's easier to take things away than to add it when you get older. And I just think it's such a more enjoyable way of doing it as well.
That makes so much sense, because it is, now you're saying that, I'm thinking back to how I was coached, and it was all about safety. You know, if a cross was 50-50 to come for it, it'd normally be a case of, well, you know, if you come and miss it, they might score. So, you know, turn, set on your line, try and make the save. Kicks, keep hitting an area. In terms of starting positions, you know, you'd be that little bit deep. So all these things that you kind of, and I suppose it's that bandwidth in it. Once you can't necessarily break free of that, breaking the comfort zones. Whereas actually, if you start and you're doing that, I think it was such a fear of criticism as well. Like, it felt back then that you'd want to get through, or this is a personal thing, actually. I felt like I wanted to get through games not making a mistake, as opposed to everything we've touched on here, being effective, playing on the front foot, coming for the... There was a cross. I know how much football you watch, so you might have seen this. And I actually text Ben Roberts straight away when I saw Robert Sanchez, last minute of a game, out swinging corner. He's come about 9 yards to come and catch the cross. And I'm like...
I was there.
Oh, were you at the game? How good was that? Do you know what? It's a small moment that not even the commentators picked up. But I'm watching. I had to text him instantly just to say that is... Because that's everything I wanted to be as a kid. But that, no chance I'd have been coming for that. Last minute of a game, 1-0 up. That would have been set on your line and don't make an error. See that, you know, and it gets such a different mentality to that. But I guess everything you're saying, you push so many boundaries, it's so much easier to come the other way and become that bit safer if that's what a manager or a coach wants.
Yeah, correct. And I suppose the example I would give just to like paint the picture would be. So if I was to ask you, Rich, to think back when you were, you know, not necessarily a young goalkeeper, you know, adolescent, 15-year-old, where would you have been told or taught to support play for a back pass?
Oh, it was, well, for a start, it wasn't really a conversation, but it would have been, I'd have been very deep. And if they had to pass it back, then it was a case of getting a good connection, you know, seeing if I could get a good one-touch connection.
And I think, you know, even on the FA courses back then, like that's what you were taught. It was support outside your goal, near side to the ball and stay deep, give yourself as much time as possible. Yeah. But the actual answer to that is where, you know, I'll ask you the same question now, you know what you know. Where should you support a back pass?
Yeah, well, it certainly wouldn't be anywhere near as deep. It would be, I mean, for me, it's I mentioned MK Dons earlier. Like, again, they're taking it to kind of different levels in terms of like the angles that they're making, where at times you're kind of out towards the side of the box, either side of the box, receiving, looking to pass it into the sitting midfielder, bouncing it off, then into the fullback, maybe clips over to the winger. So actually, if anything, you're edge of the box a lot of the time.
Yeah, so I think like how you just answered that is interesting, because like before, your first response was safety, no risk, stay deep. But now your answer, you're actually thinking, where do I need to pass it?
Yeah.
So like although you've not articulated the answer that clearly, your two different mindsets were really clear to me. One was, don't take a risk. The second one was, how do I help the team?
Yeah.
So I think the answer to that is, where do you support for back pass? Depends where the pressure's coming from and where the space is. Mm. And if you don't teach someone or help people recognise where space is, where pressure's coming from, how are they going to know where to support play? And one of my first jobs at the FA, one great Tomo to chuck me in it, but he got me to demonstrate when the UEFA A licence goalkeeping became ratified by UEFA, we had to convert everyone who'd done it previously. So there were about 100 coaches came in. I'm talking, everyone was there. Like you name a goalkeeping coach who's worked at the top in England, and they were there, and Packy, and Jim Stewart, Franz could have been there. And it was like, right, Tim, you're doing the practical demo. So I was like, flipping it, here we go. So I thought, right, I'm going to do one on In Possession. And it was basically about supporting. When do you support towards the ball? When do you support away from the ball? And basically when to play high and deep. And I've got keepers, I've put a session on which is allowing the goalkeepers to leave the goal on the ball, opposite side of the ball. Ball's getting played across the box and people are pulling their hair out and like, you can't do that. That's like not right. You know, we've never done that. We can't do that. And it was like, well, never and can't. Really? You know, would it never happen? Can't you do it? And, you know, I love it now when you see, you know, goalkeepers now supporting all angles, recognising space, making the strikers run. You know, the striker's like, flipping, I can't run all the way over there now. So, no, it's been quite nice watching that, like, involvement. And what is the nicest bit is some of them coaches have ended up looping back round and have been like, you know, 2 or 3 years later, you couldn't send me a session on that. Couldn't send me some drills on that, could you?
Do you know, it all comes back to what you said about the how to think, though. That's where that all then fits together, because it is that, like you say, it isn't black and white. It isn't, there is a set position that they need to be in. It is understanding what the flow of the game, what's going on elsewhere, where to take up that position, where the pass is, and also not just passing for the sake of passing, kind of understanding your exit routes and, you know, how you can, how you can, again, be that much more effective in starting an attack effectively.
And the keeper's like, the keeper's just amaze you. Like, and you talked about MK Dons there and two extremes and stuff. Like, I've seen England official fixtures, like against other nations, can't remember what age groups, but I've seen the goalkeeper play a 1-2 with his centre-back and then step past the striker and receive it back the other side of him, which I know you might say is an extreme, but like, does a 16-year-old really need to take no risk then? Or can you tell him to stop that a bit later down the line? You know, that can be someone else's job, that, you know, keep them boundaries broad early on and, you know, restrict and define them, you know, the later down their career, which other coaches can do.
Okay, Tim, this has been brilliant. I've really enjoyed this. I've got a couple more questions before Rich gets to the final question. I've also been a bit busy, by the way, as well. I think the quote you were referring to was the everyone is born a genius, but the process of living de-geniuses them. Is that the one?
Nice. Yeah, perfect.
But love that.
If you can edit, if you can re-edit that back into before, that'd be perfect.
What I would like to ask you really to finish from my perspective is we've got Euros coming up in the summer. It's not all just about the senior men's England team, of course, but
yeah.
Where for you right now are we at? You know, there are a number of great English goalkeepers throughout all four tiers of English football. People often romanticise about the past and the great goalkeepers, a few of which you've mentioned during this chat. Where are we at, in your opinion, now with England goalkeeping?
We are in a better place than it is portrayed. The media, the society, social media, all that kind of stuff is so reactive to every action, every game, every incident, every moment, you know, and we just move with noise so much. You know, I see last night that Dean made a save late in the game, and you know, I did watch the game, but I was just going to bed afterwards, and you know, I see news articles popping up saying, should he be England's number one? And it's like, should someone get the England number one spot because they make one save at the end of a game? It's just, that is just the extremeness of it, isn't it? And the same the other way, you know, they make one mistake and they're a disaster. Mm-hmm. So hand on heart, I believe we are in a better place than people think. Can we be better? And do we need to improve? 100% we do, but we're in a good place. And these lads are all young as well. These lads are young. So the three incumbents at the moment, you know, Jordan, Nick and Dean, they're very young. You know, they've all still got upwards of 5 years left, easy. Obviously, Dean and Jordan, a lot more than that. But, and then behind them are other lads who are coming through, other lads who are percolating through and they're going on loan spells. And I don't need to name check them because that's not fair to do that. But you know, you can do your own research and work out who they are. And I believe we're in a good place, and I'm more than confident with where we're headed and where we're going that we could perform well.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, you know, before my final question, I have just got one small one on that, because you mentioned that, and I was going to touch on that I think at the moment, the amount of English goalkeepers playing in the Premier League, the amount of English goalkeepers playing in the Championship, the amount of young English goalkeepers that are coming through and getting good experience, and it does seem, as you say, in terms of where English goalkeeping is on the whole, and something like this, it doesn't just happen overnight. You know, this is kind of, you put a process in place. I always remember hearing about Germany, wasn't it, before they won there, was it the Euros or the World, I think the Euros, wasn't it? And it was like a 10-year project because, of course, changing an idea and to create, it takes time, and it is then that group of goalkeepers that comes through. So for you now, you're this far into the journey, there's obviously always work to do, but do you have the next few years mapped out in your mind as to how you see English goalkeeping developing?
Yeah, 100%. Mapped out in a sense of like, we know where we want it to go and we know what we have to do to contribute towards it, but also that we're flexible enough to move with what can happen with a bad loan or an injury or bad form. You know, it happens a lot. So we're adaptable and ready to move. But yeah, you're right what you say about a long-term plan. And I got asked by the Athletic or the Guardian did an article that they asked me to speak about. I think it said like a new era for the England generation goalkeeper, something. It's about a year or two ago. And I was like, yeah, we're in a good place. We've got some exciting young goalkeepers that are doing good stuff, but they will be judged on how they play for the next 5 to 10 years, not by emerging at the top. They're not, you know, a lot get to the top, but staying at the top and then performing at that level is how they will be judged. So my answer was kind of like, ask us again, or you know, ask the same question in 5-10 years.
So true. Tim Dittmer, right, final question. It has been an absolute pleasure. Really, really interesting. Gone here, there and everywhere. But the final question, always the same question. Tim Dittmer, what has goalkeeping given you?
Wow. Opportunity. Opportunity to develop myself, to help develop others, and to hopefully provide like change and difference in the game. It's just a great, you know, we're all privileged to be involved in it, aren't we? It's a privilege to work with the guys and girls on the pitch, off the pitch, speak to coaches, help coaches, and it's just provided me with a real, you know, source of motivation to help people, really. That would be, I think, the best way to describe it.
Tim Dittmer, thank you very much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks, guys. Good luck with it.
So there we go. Tim Dittmer, the England goalkeeping DNA. We know what's required now to go and be an England goalkeeper.
We do indeed. And he has now shared the DNA with us, which will be going up on our Twitter very soon, I'm sure. But look, fantastic. I just thought there was so much valuable content that he's given there. Got into such detail as well. We tried to do that with the interview. Of course, we talk about this a lot, that now we try to go down a slightly different approach rather than as much as his story is fascinating and fantastic, I guess it's more looking for tangible advice, things that he can give you, the listener, whether you are a young goalkeeper coach, you can take away with you and really make the most of. And hopefully we did that.
We're not going to re-quote the whole podcast again, but a few bits that really stuck out for me when he said he was sat in that room with Richard Hartis and Jack Robinson trying to thrash out what the identity of an England goalkeeper could be and the outcome-based characteristics. And, you know, the fact that he said is able to make good saves, effective in their actions, outstanding in their distribution, can exploit space and can move efficiently. Not defining you can do it in a certain way, but just saying you have to be able to have this outcome, right? And the fact that he said it leaves wriggle room, individualization, and empowerment for coaches and players to bring their uniqueness to the game. We're getting much more variety in our goalkeepers rather than just one type. And when you said at the top of the show that he articulated himself well, that is a prime example of it.
Yeah, hugely. I think that, look, you've got some top goalkeeping minds around a table there. And effectively what they've done is they've considered the outcome and they've then chunked down. They've looked backwards and set the whole process up. And we can see, you know, certainly talk about it bearing fruit, like the amount of young English goalkeepers that are now coming through. And certainly we talk about a lot on this show every single week. And we're aware of a lot that are just sat beneath the surface that are going to be coming into the fore very, very soon. And a lot of this is due to the good work they're doing.
And I think it just shows, doesn't it, the detail that they go to, especially at England in particular now, that he just seems so busy. He said he puts a lot of hours in, and it's not about saying to your coaches, you have to come up with these characteristics either, is it? It's very much saying, this isn't a blanket rule across the board, you must follow this, come up with your own. It reminded me a bit of when we spoke to Alex Stepney, you know, when he was saying that he referred to an FA handbook or something, didn't he, when he was trying to be a goalkeeper coach, and he said it was nonsense, and it said, you basically have to coach this way. It's a bit different now, isn't it?
It is. It's always according to the individual because, of course, look, we talk about it so often on here that each goalkeeper has different strengths and one strength might work for one team, whereas another strength might work for another team. And I think the fact as well that he's building such strong relationships with all the goalkeeper coaches, which kind of sounds like an obvious thing to do, but it really isn't. You know, quite often club football and international football can be kept quite separate. But I think the fact that he is and they are embracing the day-to-day coaches of a lot of these lads and working with them to try and maximize what that goalkeeper can be and can offer. And again, I just love the mentality behind everything that's going on. I mean, look, a lot's been said since Gareth Southgate has taken charge of the men's national team. And obviously a lot's happened even before then, a lot of these foundations put in place. But I just love the way in which all of them are going about what they're doing and what they're creating for. And for us, as you know, the fact that we are English and we want the national team to do as well as it can, it's just so nice to know that these minds are behind what's going on. It's so process driven. It is very much about learning environments, that pursuit of excellence. And the fact that this is happening at the lower age groups, the younger age groups, we're going to see that. We're already seeing it with the men's national team now, but it won't be long before we're the best in the world. You just get that impression given a lot of the plans they're putting in place.
Before we go, a name that cropped up quite a bit in that podcast was Martin Thomas. Mm. Can you just explain to anyone who doesn't know who Martin Thomas is, who Martin Thomas is?
Legend. That's all you need to know. Legend.
Really?
Oh, he's amazing. Yeah, do you know, every goalkeeper, there's so many goalkeepers listening to this now that will have trained with Martin Thomas at some period of time, and you cannot help but come out of a training session with him feeling like $1 million. And I had him as a couple of camps when I was younger with England, and just leaves an impression on you. Welsh guy, he must be in his 60s, I'm guessing now, because obviously talking about it there that he's retiring. But just brilliant sessions, fast tempo. You always felt like you did a really good amount of work. And again, so complimentary with everything good you're doing, but just a brilliant coach when it came to the details as well. So look, I'm sure everybody, every goalkeeper would be sad to hear that he is retiring, because he will have left such a positive imprint on everybody that worked with him.
Richard Lee, thank you.
Matthew Beadle, thank you.
Doing the whole first name, surname thing that Tim Dittmer used to adopt.
See what you were doing. That now makes sense, yes.
Didn't realise that at first,
did you?
Didn't
at all, no. I reciprocated for no... But there you go, that proves his point. You have got my attention.
There you go. This has been the Goalkeepers Union podcast. Keepers.
Wait.